Well, it is my pleasure today to introduce to you Dr. Stephen Schuler, who I told him I was going to introduce him as a friend of the family, because he is. Actually, way back when we started with Pop Therapy, he was really influential in helping Pablo Prides design his interventions. I remember Pablo being on the phone with you for hours talking about how to design real psychological interventions that people would actually use. So he's here, but he's here from the University of Northwestern University, from the Department of Preventive Medicine and the Center for Behavioral Intervention Technologies, or they call it CBIT. He's also a director of a, remind me the name of it again?
CyberGuide,
right, which is a super useful tool. The thing that's interesting about Stephen is he really works on making mental health and well-being interventions accessible and universally available to all, which we love here. So I'm sure he'll tell you all about that today. Thank you for coming.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So as Mary said, my name is Stephen Schuler. I'm in the Department of Preventive Medicine at Northwestern University, and I'm trained as a clinical psychologist. And a lot of the work that I do right now lays at the intersection of sort of three fields, clinical psychology, design and human-computer interaction, and implementation science. And so one of the questions that really drives me now is there's been a lot of evidence that shows that technology-based mental health can be useful, but it really hasn't caught on despite this rampant enthusiasm for developing these sorts of things. And so really, I think that we as a field need to consider how can we make sure that the stuff that we develop actually gets used in places where it can be helpful for people. So I'm going to go through some examples of some of the work that I'm doing that kind of spans different ways of thinking about how to get technologies out there, how to evaluate technologies, how to build technologies for diverse groups, and conclude with some thoughts about, you know, the future of sort of mobile mental health. So, again, I'm a clinical psychologist, I imagine, and I know most of the people here at Microsoft are not clinical psychologists. And so I want to talk a little bit about the scope of the problem, but then also how I think more about sort of mental health as it applies more broadly. So I work mostly in the area of depression. Depression is a very wide spread problem. So depression is actually the largest contributor to disability. Approximately 1 in 5 folks in the United States will experience a mental health disorder. So by that, I mean a clinically diagnosable version of a mental health condition. So depression and anxiety are the most common, but, you know, also more serious mental illness like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. These things are, you know, just extremely prevalent. It's not, you know, 1 in 5 means it's not like someone you know somewhere in your social network has a mental disorder. This means that, you know, the people that you interact with on a daily basis, the people who are intimately involved in your life, experience mental health issues. The other thing I want to kind of point out in this figure over here is that, you know, mental health is not just about presence or absence of disorders, but it's also a continuum of functioning. So I think this is sort of a good representation that, you know, we think usually when we think about sort of mental health disorders, we think about, you know, disorders versus everything else. But everyone experiences times in their life where they experience some degree of mental health challenge. What this kind of yellow box here is reacting. So reacting means like something's going on in your life. I have 2-year-old triplets. I can tell you that when those kids were born, it was a very stressful time. My mental health was not the best state at that time. That didn't mean I had a mental health disorder. That meant, you know, I was experiencing a time in my life that was stressful. Wasn't sleeping as well, you know, wasn't eating as well, wasn't being as active, you know, all these things that kind of promote mental health. And so that's also something that we need to address as mental health professionals and as folks who are interested in promoting mental health, to acknowledge that the stressors that come up in our lives and how we react to those are also things that we can develop tools and resources to help people with. So it's not just, am I healthy or am I, you know, do I have a mental disorder, but all these sort of steps along that line. So I have this quote here from the former U.S. Surgeon General, there's no health without mental health. And what I often say is it's not just 1 in 5, you know, Americans have a mental health disorder. 100% of Americans have to deal with mental health. This is something that we should be thinking about. This, on the other hand, is a very depressing figure for me. So what this figure shows is the representation of licensed psychologists. This is only psychologists, but if I showed you any other sort of figure that was a representation of mental health professionals, it would look about the same. So there's about 196,000 licensed clinical psychologists in the U.S. 33% of U.S. counties have not one single licensed mental health professional. So in the red, you see places where there's a very high concentration of mental health professionals. So if you live on the coast, either coasts, if you live in kind of Chicago area, you can probably find a clinical psychologist. If you live anywhere else, you're going to be in trouble. And if you live in sort of this big stretch of the country here, that's where we have a, you know, a real sort of dearth of professionals. So there's lots of places where you don't have the choice to even get professional mental health services if you want them. And so this is a big problem that I think technology has a potential to kind of overcome. So, of course, there's an app for everything. We know this, and there's been rapid development of mental health apps. So this is kind of based off a report from the IMS Institute that came out in 2015. I mean, I know that's a little outdated now. I'll say that when they did the same report in 2013, they estimated there were about 100,000 mental health apps. So from 2013 to 2015, it jumped by nearly 50%, a little bit more than 50%. So they estimated in 2015 that there were roughly 165,000 health apps that are out there. There's a more recent report from a different institute I saw that estimated about 250,000, which would be keeping up with about the rate of development that we've seen there. About roughly 12,000 of those are focused towards mental health. That's a ton of stuff that's out there. We don't know, you know, how good all these things are. We don't know how helpful they are. But there's a lot of different things out there that are purported to be able to help people for different mental health disorders. Here's just a little bit of review of looking at the scientific evidence behind those things. These come from two separate systematic reviews, where what the authors did in both of these papers is they looked at all the apps that were publicly available on the app stores focused on a particular problem. So the top one focuses on depression. This lower one focuses on anxiety. The findings are relatively similar in that, you know, for depression, they found 117 apps. For anxiety, they found 316. About 10% of those were consistent with evidence-based practices. And by that, I mean they went to the content of the applications. They looked what was in there, and they saw, does this coincide with what someone would recommend people to do from sort of evidence-based psychological practices? So about 10% of the time, those apps were actually consistent. They're actually, in several reviews, we find that there's a lot of apps that even have maybe harmful content. There's one that's cited pretty regularly for bipolar disorder, where it tells you if your moods are kind of getting more disruptive. You know, this mood swings that are very common in bipolar. You might try to help it by drinking more, because that will, you know, depress your moods. And it's this information is out there, and it's, you know, if it's, you know, it's these apps are sort of useless at best sometimes and harmful at the worst. And so we really need a lot more resources and efforts to try to be able to provide useful information to consumers about what mental health apps are out there, which ones might be useful, which ones might be good. The sort of typical way we think about evaluating things in medicine and clinical psychology is through sort of a gold standard randomized controlled trial. You know, where we have random assignment to two different programs. You would do a pretest, you do the program, you do a post-test. This is really great, but unfortunately, to do sort of the size of trials that we typically think about in clinical psychology as in what we would want in these gold standard measurements, this is an extremely slow process. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't evaluate some things through randomized controlled trials, but I also think that in the context of digital mental health, we have to think about other evaluation strategies that can supplement the information we gain from randomized controlled trials. So, as Mary mentioned, I am the executive director of a project called CyberGuide. The goal at CyberGuide is to identify, curate, and disseminate information about mental health apps. We're funded by the One Mind Institute, which is a nonprofit that promotes mental health research. And we try to provide, you know, unbiased information, kind of like the consumer reports of digital mental health. So what does the CyberGuide website look like? What sort of things do we provide for folks? We try to organize different mental health apps around different disorder categories, ranging from mood disorders, things like depression, schizophrenia, serious mental illness, PTSD, and other anxiety disorders, and as well as sort of general wellness tools made to promote mental health sort of more generally. We divide things up also by the type of strategy that they have. I'll say that most of the tools in the area of sort of depression and anxiety tend to be cognitive behavioral therapy based. This is the strongest, this is the treatment with the strongest evidence base in clinical psychology. This does not necessarily mean that it's the strongest treatment. It means that it's the most easily, it's the most manualized treatment. So that I mean that we as clinical psychologists have kind of laid down, if you want to do cognitive behavioral therapy, this is how you do it. This is what your sessions could cover. These are the tools that you need. And so it's been subjected to the most of these randomized controlled trials. So I'm not saying it's the only thing that works, but I'm saying that it's the thing with the most evidence that shows that it works. We also have a lot of symptom trackers. These are very popular, as I'll talk about later. A lot of mindfulness tools. I'll say just as sort of a point of what people are interested in mobile mental health. On the CyberGuide website, besides our main page and our product guide, which obviously have the most views because that's where people kind of go through the site, the most popular piece of content on our site is the review we post of Headspace. Headspace is an extremely popular mental health app. It has, I think, an estimated 10 million people who've used it. The founder of Headspace, his TED Talk has 7 million views. Like, people really, really like Headspace. Whether, again, that means it's the best mental health app out there, I think that's, you know, debatable. I've personally, you know, I've used Headspace. It doesn't really capture, you know, me, but I'm also not really a strong, you know, meditator. But it's one that's extremely popular with people. So if you click on our product guide, you'll see a listing of different mental health apps. We list three different ratings on our website right now. One is the CyberGuide rating, which is a measure of credibility. Through the CyberGuide rating, we look at sort of the evidence base. Is there scientific evidence that suggests that this mental health app is useful? Is it created by a scientific team, or does it have scientific or clinical advisor support that would suggest that these are people who know how to create and design effective clinical interventions? Is it updated frequently? Does it have support behind the product? Is it coming from a nonprofit or is it coming from a for-profit organization? The next thing we look at is using something called the Mobile App Rating Scale. This is a measure that was developed from folks out of the University of Queensland to evaluate health apps. It focuses a lot on like the usability and user experience. It could be that there's an app that has very good credibility, but is very hard to use. I think we see this a lot because oftentimes in scientific studies, to get people to use apps or to get people to participate in the study, they're incentivized through financial incentives. There might be a lot of sort of education on how to use that app in that randomized controlled trial. So that means if people are really motivated to use this and they get a lot of sort of troubleshooting around it, they'll use it and they can benefit. But if you put it out there and you don't have that support, people might have a hard time using it. So I think that, again, you kind of need both of these things to make a really useful application. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here that, you know, effectiveness, usefulness is not just does it work, but, you know, can people use it? But this is an important piece that's usually left out in a lot of the psychological discussion from the clinical psychology background of these tools. And then lastly, we have expert reviews for some of these apps, which is we have an expert in the field who knows that content area. If it's cognitive behavioral therapy app for depression, we might have a depression expert. If it's a mindfulness app, we might have a mindfulness expert. But they create more of a narrative for users about how you might use this app, how it might be able to benefit you. So just a little bit of discussion around what we've found from mental health apps through this endeavor of rating them. From CyberGuide ratings, we rate everything on a 14-point scale and then present everything as a percentage. So apps can range from 0 to 100, hypothetically. Our actual range is 14 to 93%, with an average of 52%. There's some apps that look really credible out there. There's some apps that look really bad. At CyberGuide, we try to not just rate the good apps because we feel if someone finds an app, we want them to know, you know, if they find Brain HQ, we want them to know, like, is this a good app? Is this not a good app? And so we really try to shy away from a strategy of identifying and recommending specific apps. Our goal is really to put the information out there in a useful way for consumers. So you can see from the percentiles that it does look like a lot of the apps do pretty well on this credibility rating. A lot of apps, I should say, cluster around the center in terms of credibility rating. So there's not a lot at this high end. There's not a lot at this low end. There's a lot of apps that, you know, there's some, it might be useful. We don't really know. For the Mars ratings, 60% of our products have these Mars ratings. Every product listed has a CyberGuide rating. The range here, again, is 1.63 to 4.75 with an average of 3.5. So things do okay on this user rating scale. Again, the interquartile range shows that a lot of stuff kind of clusters in the middle there. I'll say that these credibility and these Mars rating scales are almost not correlated at all. So the correlation between these things are about an R of 0.2. And I say, like, not correlated at all because practically anything you correlate in psychology will get an R of like 0.2. Like, it just happens. Like, things are somewhat correlated. They also don't correlate very highly with the ratings off of the public app stores, neither the Mars rating nor the CyberGuide rating. So it seems like if we just look at the user ratings of scores, that's not really representing either the credibility or the user experience of an app. So it's hard to say then from a user's perspective when they go and rate these applications on app stores what they're actually looking at. I'll also say in terms of public-facing app store ratings, so things off of the Google Play Store and the Apple iTunes Store, there's a lot of these applications that are very popular in either the clinical literature or the popular literature that have no public sort of rating of on the app stores because they don't have enough ratings. That at least on the iTunes store, you need a certain number of ratings before it'll actually display the average. And usually, most of these mental health apps don't have them. I think about 10% of the apps that we've looked at actually have publicly available ratings on the app stores. In terms of the expert reviews, about 30% of our products have expert reviews. And we, so the expert reviews do look at the higher range of the product. So we have an average CyberGuide rating of 60 and an average Mars rating of 3.79. So again, we try to focus on the upper range of products there. We don't really feel like we need to provide consumers with a lot of information about how to use the products that we don't seem to be all that good. We really want to direct people to things that we think might be more useful. So one of the things actually we'd like to do more in the future with CyberGuide is we want to look more also at integrating the user experience of their impression of these applications. As I said, the public consumer marketplaces of app stores, that those ratings don't really relate to the information that we're gathering. And so we'd like to gain more understanding of, you know, what it is that people like and don't like about applications and how we can present that back to them. So that's one thing that we're really kind of focusing on now is how do we engage the consumers as stakeholders in terms of contributing information that we can then disseminate. I think this is a really big need for digital mental health more generally is engaging stakeholders more in the process of both the development and the evaluation piece of this. Yeah?
Does the FDA regulate any of these mental health apps?
The FDA does not currently regulate any of these mental health apps. The FDA only regulates health apps if they are used for the purposes of assessment of providing an intervention. So if you developed an app that was meant to sort of diagnose you for a mental disorder and then provide that information to your clinician, it would be arguable that that would be, should be regulated by the FDA. These apps are really sold as sort of do-it-yourself or self-management tools, and so they don't fall under the FDA regulation. There is one app I know that was on track for FDA approval, and that was an app that was created by Pear Therapeutics that was made to be used in the context of substance use. But that was one, again, that helped diagnose people and then provided that information to their provider. So it really has to be under the current sort of FDA purview of what they've said they're going to regulate in digital health space. It needs to be used in the context of treatment.
So the mental health is similar then to the fitness apps that are out there as well?
Exactly. Yep. Okay. Yep.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way of recording adverse events? So does anybody track these?
You know, no. Not in sort of the public space. I think that's one thing I think is also really important is where the, like this bipolar app I mentioned that, you know, has this very sort of potentially dangerous recommendation in there. And I think, again, right now it's a very sort of wild west. And that would be a good thing to kind of get is like collecting more information about when these apps do go seriously wrong.
I apologize if I'm mistaken. I believe that APA also has an app rating system.
By APA, do you mean the American Psychological Association or the American Psychiatric Association?
Shoot, I don't know.
So the American Psychiatric Association does have an app rating system. It follows a lot of the same kind of guidelines of what we do in CyberGuide. It's meant more to be a consumer framework. So what the American Psychiatric Association has done is it sets up sort of a tiered system of if you're a consumer and you want to look at a mental health app, these are the things you should consider. Privacy and security, effectiveness, user experience, interoperability. I think that's really great, but I think as a consumer, I would have, if you told me about, if I went to go buy a car and you told me, these are the things you should consider when you're buying a car, safety, gas mileage, all these things, you can tell me to evaluate those things, but I'm not going to know how to do it. And so I think that's a little bit of where I think that the American Psychiatric Association framework does a really nice job of saying what we should look at, but I think that consumers often need that sort of extra step to get there.
Did you use it as kind of a guide?
A lot of the sort of areas that we cover overlap with the American Psychiatric Association, with the exception of the privacy security section. That's something we're debating a lot internally. So there was a group that tried to evaluate health apps more generally, known as Haptique. And Haptique got in big trouble because they had a model where they would do individual sort of certification of apps, kind of like you would want the FDA to do perhaps. And they got into hot water when there are a couple apps that they sort of signed off on. It was shown that they were actually selling users' data to third parties. And so I think that's one of the problems that you run into with this privacy and security is that it's hard to know sometimes with these apps where the data actually is going, what people are doing with data, and some organizations are not so clear with that. And so again, it's hard to provide sort of a recommendation of this is a secure app if you don't have all the information from it yourself.
If I'm in the app store and I'm looking for an anxiety app, how would I even know that CyberGuide existed?
That's a great question. I think that that's one thing that we are trying to do is partner with organizations. We have an agreement with Mental Health America to partner with their screening exercise where people get screened through Mental Health America and then can get recommendations for different services. Right now there's no way of knowing that. And I think without teaming with those app stores themselves, that's going to be a problem that is not going to be able to be overcome. So I want to transition to a little bit more research around how and why people use mental health apps. This is a Penny Arcade comic that I really like that makes me think about this from years ago, where apps were really just blowing up and the two characters are fighting about whether one should buy a console game or app games. And I love this quote here, will you buy one 3DS game, a Nintendo game, and I'll buy 40 games on my phone and we'll see who has more fun. So sort of this idea of you can spend $40 on one game or I can spend $40 on 40 different games and we'll see who actually gets more enjoyment out of this, kind of arguing for this model of diversity in terms of products. So one of the things that we did recently is we looked at users who were entering into or are interested in entering into different clinical trials that we were doing at the Center for Behavioral Intervention Technologies. And before they got onboarded into any of our trials, we actually just simply asked them, what sort of health apps do you have on your phone? What sort of mental health apps do you have on your phone? Why do you use these apps? What are the app names? And we found that most people used mental health multiple apps. The average was 2. There was a range from 0 to 20. So again, this isn't suggesting that people are finding one health app and they're using it. They're using this, this Penny Arcade sort of model of, trying a bunch of different things and seeing what's helpful for them. About 1/4 of them were mental health or wellness apps, which corresponds, somewhat with the sort of overall representation. Again, probably this number is a bit elevated from the general population because these are all people who are entering into a clinical trial that was focused on mental health. 92.8% were free. And it's worth noting that this is not representative of the overall sort of marketplace of mental health apps. So people are disproportionately focused on downloading free apps for their health, which I think is really interesting. And also, you know, again, not representative if you just look at the sort of the marketplace review of what's out there. In our data, we found if we looked at the purposes for the applications, the most common reason people said they were using mental health applications was for tracking purposes. About 40% of the apps that people were using, they said they were using for some sort of tracking purpose. What was really interesting to me, actually, was that when we looked at the names of the different apps that people were using, there was not a large proportion, but there was a proportion of apps that they noted that were not mental health apps. They were not health apps at all. They were things like Snapchat, like Google Documents, like Facebook, like Twitter. And people actually reported using these different things for health purposes. And so I think that's another sort of interesting piece to this puzzle here, that as you know, clinical psychologists, we often look at the App Store, we look at things, you know, people search for anxiety, people search for depression, and those are the things we're kind of evaluating. But there's a lot of way that people might be using non-health apps for health purposes. And I think that we as a field should better understand when that's going on, what people are getting out of that, and how we can actually maybe build some of these tools to better meet the mental health needs that people are having when they're going to these different things. So I want to kind of loop back to that IMS report, because I think it actually has some interesting points to make about what the apps actually do in terms of functionality. So if back in 2015, when the IMS looked at all the different health apps that are available, they noticed that about half the apps had a single functionality. So that means that most of the apps do one thing, and that most of the time that functionality was to inform people. So effectively, most health apps that are out there are psychoeducational tools that teach people things. They're self-help books that have been made into an app format. Self-help books are great. We've had them for years. They can be useful for people. But I think what's going on here is a sad opportunity, a lost opportunity, I should say, to use the true sort of affordances of digital technologies to do really sort of creative things in the health space. I think it was about 5% here of apps that were used for communication purposes. So the ability to connect people either to each other, and that was actually what was most common, is that, so of that small percentage of apps that have communication purposes, most of the time those apps are allowing people to connect to social media. Maybe that's the best thing for health apps to do, maybe it's not. I'm not gonna, you know, open up the debate here, but I'm just saying, like, that's the most common communication purpose, is let's share our health information to social media. 34% were to social networks, again, sort of a social, you know, component to that. 2% were to providers. So very few health apps actually have any sort of information of interoperability that allows information to be translated from a user to a provider. Again, I think this is a big missed opportunity. I was talking with Mary a little bit about this earlier, about how we actually can take information from different health apps and be able to share that with providers. And I think we need a lot more understanding of what providers want in those circumstances, what patients want in those circumstances, and how to best sort of translate patient needs and wants to provider needs and wants. So I want to, go ahead.
Oh, I was curious if that 2% for provider communication, is that related to just not right building that in functionality into the app to begin with because they don't want to, or is it because of EHR barrier integration barriers?
That's a good question. I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Okay.
I mean, getting information to the EHR is a huge headache. I know at Northwestern, we're just starting this new initiative called, it's like Project One or something like that, where they're trying to bring all of the instances of Epic to have one version where they'll all communicate with each other. And in the process of doing that, they've completely locked down introduction of new information to the EHR. So we can't put any information. It's just, whenever I do projects, that is a non-starter. No information gets to go into the EHR. I've seen some workarounds where it's like information can be translated into a document that can be uploaded as a attachment to a provider message. But direct integration to the EHR has been a major headache for any project that I've worked on. So I imagine that's, you know, a big barrier for a lot of other people too.
And on your JMIR study, I don't know if you've asked this question or not. Did you ask or kind of find anything in the literature about how people find out about the health apps that they use?
Is it- you know, we didn't look in that specific study. We have a current study where we're doing where we're trying to ask that question to find more like, you know, where do you come to health apps? And also what we're really interested in the current study we're doing is when they look for them, what information would be most valuable to them to kind of direct their decision? I think that's, you know, it's a big open question. I think it's worth looking to.
So on the 2% of information that does get communicated to providers, can the providers actually do anything with that information? Or is it still, like you said, that's where you have to both sides and commonize?
That's a tricky question. Maybe, can I come back to that at the end of the talk? Because I think, you know, there might be a little bit more discussion to have around that. But that's a really good and tricky question. So I want to actually go into another platform that we've developed at Northwestern that we call IntelliCare. And it takes a slightly different design perspective to mobile mental health. So what IntelliCare is instead of a single app, we developed an app suite that's organized by this hub application. So the IntelliCare app suite actually has 12 different mini applications that each focus on a specific behavior change technique. So here's a couple of them. This is actually one of our most popular apps. It's called Daily Feats. When you sign up for the app, you take a brief sort of depression anxiety screener. I'll say IntelliCare, it was intentionally designed to deal with issues of depression anxiety. So you take a depression anxiety screener. It gives you a set of tasks to do each day, daily feats. They're organized around your level of depression anxiety. So if you are pretty depressed when you start out, you'll have just very basic feats. Get out of bed, groom yourself, make good food choices, go outside. I will say these might seem very basic to you, but one of the feedback we've gotten from our users is that it's extremely empowering for them when they're seriously depressed for us to kind of reframe these things that they truly struggle with as feats to be accomplished. So you open up the application, you check off which things you do that day. If you form a streak over multiple days, you get a little indication in terms of, you know, green numbers. You have enough streaks over subsequent days, you move up to subsequent levels, and you continue to keep leveling up, get more and more challenging things. Very simple application, very easy to use, very, very popular in our suite. This isn't 5 days of completing a goal. This is an app that I developed. It's called My Mantra. I call it the Pinterest of cognitive behavioral therapy. You collect sort of pictures that organize around a positive self-affirming mantra. There's a couple example ones in here in the application. Things like I'm strong, I'm grateful, I'm resilient. And as you collect these photos, you get them fed back to you through notifications. Again, very, very simple, a popular app within our suite. This is Thought Challenger. It's maybe the most kind of classic mental health app that's in the IntelliCare suite. It helps walk you through the process of cognitive restructuring, which is this idea that the content of your thoughts is more important than the actual situation. It helps you come up with more sort of positive ways to view situations. You come up with a negative, unrealistic thought. You substitute it with a more realistic way of thinking. This walks you through the five-step process of doing it. And on the home screen, you have all of the kind of good, positive reframe thoughts, a word cloud that's generated from that content. We want to throw the positive content back at people as opposed to the negative content. So we did an 8-week field trial of the IntelliCare platform. I will say that it was done along with sort of coached support. We had a person providing some light sort of encouragement engagement through text messaging. This is the result from that single-arm field trial. We found that people over 8 weeks experienced significant reductions in their levels of depression as well as anxiety. We just recently wrapped up a 300-person four-armed randomized controlled trial of IntelliCare, so we'll have more data on this soon. This again shows, you know, similar thing, but looks at the percent of people who are in full remission or full remission or recovery, which is indicated by clinically set cut points in terms of reductions on those same scales. So people reduced in their depression and anxiety. This was actually one of the more exciting findings to me, which is that the use of IntelliCare was pretty consistent over that 8-week period. So we had an average launch of about 25 sessions per week and an average time of 1 minute per session. So people really were going to these apps multiple times per day, using them in very short bursts. And that use was sustained over this 8-week period. In most mental health apps, you see a pattern where people might use it for a week or two and then it drops off dramatically. They call this the law of attrition in digital health research, that it's pretty inevitable that people will stop using these things over time. So at least this was sort of good evidence that in this, again, it's a coached trial, so there is a human supporter there. This isn't people who are just using things on their own. We've done some evaluations of uncoached, and it's not, you know, as good as this, but it still looks fairly good in the IntelliCare suite. So this is just another thing about treatment engagement. The thing I think I want to point out here is that the average time that people, that the coaches used was 39 minutes over those 8 weeks. So again, this is a very sort of lean protocol that these coaches are doing. This is not, you know, full sort of therapy that's done through text messaging. It's, you know, about 3 text messages per week that are sent to the user to sort of encourage them to continue to use the platform. Yeah.
Or emails every day?
So there's some notifications through the apps. It's organized by, we have a hub app that actually provides messaging, and so all those notifications hit the central hub, so they're all kind of contained within the app. Another thing actually within that hub app is one thing that we're really interested in is if we can use this IntelliCare platform as a recommendation engine. And so one of the arms in that, so I'll say that forearm field trial is a 2x2 design. So we compared coaching versus no coaching, and we compared a full IntelliCare Hub app that had notifications and recommendations. So every week you would get a new recommendation that says, this week try out these 2 IntelliCare apps for you, versus an IntelliCare app, a Hub app that just had the sort of available IntelliCare apps within that hub. So no notifications and no recommendations. So one of the things that we're really interested in is, can we actually take these apps and then figure out which, you know, app should a person use in the next week? So this is just a little representation of what that IntelliCare hub looks like. This is the non-recommending version of the hub app. So in the recommending version, you'll have a little box here that will say, these are the 2 apps you should use this week. So right now, it looks like initial data suggesting that we're actually able to increase use of the applications through these recommendations, and that this specific recommendation, that the recommendation engine that we're using is actually improving on a naive recommender that's just giving random recommendations. So it does seem like we're able to do a little bit of this recommendation, but I think this is something where we have a lot of kind of room to improve in our platform. Yeah.
When you are recommending within the city, are you, I mean, obviously you're recommending, prescribing them to use this.
Yeah.
And that other arm, when you just gave them coached or non-coached, do they get to choose?
Which
were there any choice
yeah.
then with using
yep. the Yeah, exactly. Well, even in the recommended one, they could use other apps too.
Okay. Okay.
So it's not that those are the only ones available to them. We're just pushing them towards particular ones.
Okay.
And we do, these apps are all freely available on the Google Play Store. A couple of them are on iOS. We've either got, I think we've got 3 to 5 that are on iOS already. I know the development is kind of rolling out for all of the iOS ones. We do find that people from the public store who download the hub tend to download more applications than people who don't download the hub too. So this hub points people to things that they wouldn't be finding otherwise, just looking at IntelliCare apps generally from the Play Store.
And is there any support from healthcare provider and recommending or kind of influencing?
So we have not tested it within a healthcare system yet. That's a project we have on the horizon, is actually doing this in healthcare settings where your providers or a member of your provider team would be, you know, that supporter. So far, our supporters have we start out with clinical psychologists from our group. We moved to research assistants because, as I said, we're not doing very fancy stuff with the recommendations here. And I mean, one thing we're also really interested in is if we could automate some of those recommendations through using natural language processing, because at least our reports from the people doing the support is that it's not, what they're doing is not stuff that is all that challenging. But yeah, I think these are a lot of open questions we have with how we might be able to use this platform. So I want to move on to another sort of pilot study that we've been working on in Chicago, aimed at providing mental health resources to homeless youth. So About every year, about 2 million folks ages kind of 18 through 24 will spend a night homeless. And the rates of mental health disorders in homeless individuals are about 2 to 3 times higher than the general population. At the same time, only about 10% of those folks get any sort of access to mental health resources. So we have a population, a highly vulnerable population, huge sort of need for mental health services, very little sort of availability. So what we've done in Chicago is we've launched a project that we call Stepping Stone. Stepping Stone has a couple different components. First, every youth who signs up for our study, we give them a smartphone device that's theirs to keep, and we pay for 6 months of their data service. It's one thing that we feel very strongly is that keeping them connected to having technology as a resource is very beneficial for them. This has been an interesting challenge. We've learned a lot of sort of interesting things around. So we give them a data plan of 5 gigabytes. They get throttled if they go above that. We had one period where our provider was switching over carriers, and that throttling was turned off. And we had a youth that used 120 gigabytes of data in 1 week. It was crazy. They're never on Wi-Fi. They're using this as their entertainment, as their communication, as everything. It's been a very interesting learning experience. In addition, we put 3 applications on their phone. We used 2 of those IntelliCare apps, one focused on meditation mindfulness called Purple Chill, another one focused on sleep hygiene called Slumber Time. We have a daily survey app on their phone called Pocket Helper. It sends a survey that asks them about what their biggest challenge was that day, what's their stress level like, what was their sleep quality like, and it feeds that information back to a therapist on our team. That therapist, they set up 3 30-minute phone calls that focus around kind of general coping skills. They also have the opportunity to text message that therapist at times outside of those phone calls. That's one reason why we're collecting this daily survey information, so that if they text or call the therapist kind of outside of those scheduled sessions, that the therapist knows a little bit more about what's going on in their life. And that's what the project consists of. This is what sort of that daily survey looks like. It gives them a coping kind of tip every day that they rate on a 5-point scale. It feeds back their survey data to them, and we ask them kind of those brief questions. So this is sort of the general model. We have a back-end dashboard that provides that information to the clinician. The clinician gets that information, and they're able to intervene if something comes up, to send kind of text message support in the moment, or as close to the moment as possible. And the youth are able to text back to our therapist. So we've run this project now with about 40 people who've been recruited. Most people really like the study. They like the tips the best. They like the apps the least. This is something that's been really interesting to us because the tips are really easy for us to develop. The apps are very expensive and hard. And so it makes me wonder sometimes, like, why are we building apps? Why don't we just send tips to people? It's a good question. Most people would recommend the study for other people. We haven't looked at the clinical outcomes yet, but we've had sort of encouraging results from the engagement. Actually, initially, our engagement looked really bimodal. People would either engage in everything, they would complete all their sessions, they would text message regularly, or they would kind of disappear completely. We've actually recently sort of had one more sort of bucket of engagement. So we have the people who don't engage at all. We have the people who complete all their phone sessions and text message regularly. And now we have a group of folks who aren't completing any of the phone sessions, but they're texting regularly with the therapist. So it seems like there's different ways to engage people in these platforms. And I think that that's an important thing to remember is, like, what is the expected use? And also, what are patterns of engagement that might be interesting and useful for the person doing it? Because I think a lot of time when we look at digital mental health, people think about adherence. They use that word a lot, and I'm a little skittish with the word adherence, because adherence kind of suggests to me that there's one way of interacting. It's like, we have a medication, you're supposed to use it 3 times a day. And, like, I don't know if digital mental health is the same sort of way. So I really like to think about this as sort of engagement or usage. But there's different ways that people might engage with the platform, and that doesn't mean that one way is necessarily the best way, or we should preference one style of engagement besides the other. I think we need to learn more about what styles of engagement are useful for different folks.
Why did they like the apps the least?
You know, I think one of the reasons is that it's not, they weren't well integrated into the program that we had. I also think that the sleep app we put on there, because that was one of our sort of first goals for this project, was to work with sleep hygiene. And the kids are actually not all that interested in sleep hygiene. There's a lot of other things that they have going on. I think their problems with depression and anxiety are also slightly different than the general population. So there's a lot of sort of emotional regulation and interpersonal issues that come up. Those are the main content that kind of came up in the text messages and the phone sessions. And we don't have apps that kind of specifically address those things. And so even though the sort of treatment, like cognitive behavioral therapy would still be a treatment strategy that would be useful, we might need to develop apps that kind of focus on the specific content areas that would be interesting to this group. So I think, you know, tailoring for a particular population is sort of really, you know, key and critical.
Yeah, one last thing on that. I was just curious about what apps you decided, how you went about deciding what apps you might put on.
One was because our funder was funding us to do sort of sleep stuff, and so we have put the sleep app on there. We're always tied a little bit by, you know, where our money is coming from. And then the mindfulness app we put on there because it reinforced a lot of the coping skills that we were teaching in our in those phone sessions. I think, that's actually something we're moving to a phase two project here. And in the phase two project, we're putting more diversity of apps on there because, you know, we have the apps available to us in the healthcare suite. It might make sense just to give them all to them and see which ones they use. So here's actually, I want to conclude real fast with a kind of conceptual thing that I talk a lot about in my work that I think I want to frame a little bit differently here because, you know, being here at Microsoft, I know that this might be a term that some people are familiar with, and I use it slightly differently than it's used commonly in the literature. So the term skeuomorphism is a term that's used a lot in, like, UI UX design to talk about visual elements that exist in digital technologies that are sort of remnants of the past physical examples of that. So, you know, I use this example here of light bulbs that look like candle flames because that's what candles look like in the past. Those things could be anything. They could be dinosaurs. They could be hockey pucks, but we decided to make them candle to look like fire. This is a, you know, great example I got from a presentation where someone says, I showed my 12-year-old son an old floppy disk. And he said, wow, cool, you 3D printed the save icon. No, that's the opposite way that works. We made a save icon that represented the way that we used to save things. I think that often in digital mental health, we actually engage in conceptual skeuomorphisms, where we take concepts from face-to-face therapy and we translate them to digital technologies. So we make web-based cognitive behavioral therapy programs where we expect people to come back on a weekly basis and spend, you know, 50 minutes going through content because that's what psychotherapy is like. When that's not the way that most people use digital technology, and that maybe is not the way that would be most helpful to them. So effectively, we are trying to fit, you know, our old model of psychological practice into these digital mediums. And I think instead what we should be doing as we think about digital mental health is sort of reimagining how we can actually take the unique affordances of technologies to build new products, new designs that actually leverage what we know about behavior change and mental health strategies, but do so in sort of the new medium of technology. So here's actually a project that I did with Lana Yarosh from University of Minnesota, where we were sort of very interested in this stakeholder engaged perspective around happiness technologies. So we did a six-week cooperative inquiry sort of co-design workshop with kids around happiness technologies. So this was a true sort of interdisciplinary project. I came in as the clinical psychologist with a background in positive psychology. We spent the first couple weeks of the workshop teaching kids about the inventing process and also teaching them positive psychology skills. So I did what, you know, I would typically do as a psychologist if I was running just a psychology workshop. And then we transitioned to, okay, now that we've empowered you with the concepts and the knowledge of positive psychology, we taught you about gratitude, we taught you about mindfulness, we taught you about sort of problem solving from a cognitive perspective, what sort of technologies would you guys build that would be able to promote well-being? And they came up with some really sort of interesting examples. This is my favorite one here. This is the mindfulness backpack. It had a little sort of distraction machine on the back to be able to take people out of whatever moment they're in. It also had a good smell generator, and the kind of good smells these kids came up with were chocolate chip cookies and the smell of their own bed. Just really sort of cool, creative things. They also came up with things that were very similar to some things that have been designed. So this was their a sort of thought tank. It used fish, which I think is kind of funny because I've seen a lot of sort of designs from different folks where they use animals or fish as kind of representations of mental sort of health processes in sort of visual displays for applications. But this one is kind of coming up with a positive cognitive reframe. So the fish here is saying, I'm smart. Kind of counteracting some negative thoughts that they had. But it was really sort of interesting, engaging, and useful to engage with this process with the kids. Another thing I thought that was really interesting was looking at the engagement strategy they came up with how would you want to entice kids to stay engaged with these different technologies? We definitely saw the sort of typical engagement strategies that come up in what a lot of people design. You know, games, gamification, health is huge, although I have a separate rant I'll tell you another time about my theories on gamification. Social support is big. But actually, some of the things I thought were really interesting were responding directly to emotions or thoughts, making these things more tangible for people. It was also really interesting, if we go back to this example here, you can see that most of the things that the kids came up with were some form of embodied technology. Wearables, backpacks, robots, watches, like they really wanted something they could touch and feel. If you look at the sort of digital mental health space, most of the stuff is software. We have very few sort of wearable, tangible technologies that are trying to promote mental health, especially in kids. I think this is a space that really would be interesting to develop. So I think that teaming with kids gave us some interesting ideas about what are different things that people would be interested in. I think more of this sort of co-design process needs to be done in digital mental health. Again, I'm probably preaching to the choir a little bit here, but I think, you know, coming from a clinical psychology background, this is typically not what clinicians do when they develop sort of new mental health technologies.
A device that slaps you if you're not being grateful.
Yeah, there was also sort of this, I actually thought this was a theme that was really sort of interesting with the kids, is that there was this interesting sort of balance between the positive and the negative, in that they wanted things that sort of identified the negative experiences that they were going through and had some ways to try to incorporate the positive aspect. And so That's a really sort of interesting dichotomy that doesn't show up in sort of more broad sort of discussion of positive psychology. So again, some of these ideas are sort of off the wall. I will say that at least in the iteration process, I think that something that was sort of unique about the way that we did this is we did this sort of long-term workshop. There were 14 sessions we did with the same kids. They came back. They learned more about the inventing process. The amount of ideas they generated sort of decreased over time. And the quality of the ideas tended to get better throughout sessions. So definitely they learned along the way, you know, how to engage in this process with us. And I think most of the times, again, I come from a clinical psychology background. I'm not a designer, even though I love this stuff. But most of the people I see doing sort of this type of work in psychology tend to do a workshop with a group of kids and move on to another workshop with another group of kids. And I think there is this sort of interesting aspect of trying to think better on how to team over the long term with the stakeholders that we're working with, because I think that's a big part of the sort of mental health journey, is like we design a lot of these sort of singular experiences and or experiences that are meant to stay stable over time, and that's not the way therapy works, that's not the way life works, that's not the way mental health works. And I think we need to better think about also how we allow tools to be flexible to allow for a variety of different interactions. So just a couple conclusions here. There's lots of mobile mental health options that are out there. They're actually being developed at a breakneck pace. You know, every single day it seems like there's some new app or new product or new something that someone's doing in digital mental health. The diversity of mobile mental health options is somewhat limited, though. A lot of people tend to be building the same sort of things. I have seen so many cognitive behavioral therapy thought record apps. We built a cognitive behavioral therapy sort of thought record app. And the quality is unknown. And so I think that one of our goals right now should be to introduce some more variants, some more diversity into the products, the designs, the things we're evaluating, and use the information we have available to us to better understand which of these things work and which of these things don't. And then again, to kind of go back to the theme I mentioned at the beginning, that this excitement, this enthusiasm for digital mental health has not been matched by implementation. We see lots of things that are out there that have been developed. We've not seen a lot of things that have really caught on. At least in the area of kind of depression and anxiety, there's been somewhere on the magnitude of 100 randomized controlled trials evaluating these things. There's not been one sort of successful implementation where these things have caught on and stayed around in a healthcare system. And I think that one of the big problems for that is these things have not been designed with implementation in mind, and we haven't really deeply thought about how these things can integrate into the healthcare systems that they're in. These are just some examples of sort of recent designs or different things in mobile mental health that have been rolled out there. And I think one thing that's been really interesting to me as an observer in this field is that we see more and more sort of work where we're seeing these things pop up in places where we don't think about these things as a mental health tool. So Facebook's efforts to try to do suicide identification or outreach, the Google Calendar's feature to sort of recommend a goal in times where we have open spaces in our calendar. This is behavioral activation. This is something we've been doing in clinical psychology for years and years and years. If you get people more active, if you get people more engaged in naturally reinforcing things, spending time with other people, being physically active, this will help your mental health. And so I think there's a lot of places where clinical psychology ideas can be what could be well implemented and integrated into existing technologies if it's done thoughtfully and if it's done usefully. This kind of goes back to the theme I sort of mentioned with the paper we did reviewing different mental health or different health apps that people were using, where people identified health uses for non-health apps. So in conclusion, I just want to acknowledge many of the people who helped me do this work, as well as some of my different funding organizations that have helped support this. And I think we have a little bit of time for questions, but I do want to kind of come back to the question of sort of integration into to healthcare settings. But thank you all for your attention.
Can you talk about that quick?
Sure, yeah. So I think it's a really tricky thing. So there's a project I've been working on right now where we developed a platform that's made to be used in the context of clinical behavioral therapy for depression. Cognitive behavioral therapy for depression. And we did that through sort of user-centered design with both patients and providers. And those groups have very different goals and very different sort of interests. And so I think we need better ways to bring the information that patients or people create into the clinical setting in ways that are usable to clinicians. And so there's another project I'm working on where we're trying to use Fitbit data in an intensive outpatient program for veterans with PTSD to try to get information about activity levels, sleep levels that might be able to inform the treatment. But I think what we really need to know is, what are sort of the treatment goals that providers have, and how can this information, this data, be most useful for the things that they're accomplishing? So I think it's a design problem, but I think it's one that's surmountable.
Sounds like a similar shape. I thought maybe you might be a little bit more advanced in like some cardiovascular health area, because we've been talking to providers there too, and a lot of information that they get at cardiovascular health is not usable to the provider. But the patients find it very interesting, whether it's relevant or not, they still find it interesting.
Yeah, I think one thing that we've found in some of the settings is that it might be the case that we're going to have to create new professions of people who are going to be able to deal with that data. Because again, like the cardiovascular folks and like providers usually don't have a lot of time. But if you could have another role sort of develop that could be at sort of the information, collector and presenter, like
health,
that might be something.
So
sure, maybe health coach, maybe something.
Some
yeah.
To provide the information.
Yep.
It's funny, the physician we were talking to about cardiovascular said the same thing. If there is some way to take all this information, boil it down to something that's useful to a treatment plan that a physician can recommend,
yep.
then they have some use for the data. Otherwise, it becomes just noise to them.
Yep.
So it sounds
exactly.
Like you're very similar.
Yep.
Well, you can look at WellDoc, right? It's prescribed.
Sorry.
By, you can look at WellDoc. That one's prescribed by physicians or pharmacists.
I don't know if I heard that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's an interesting model about how it goes about.
What was it called?
Well done.
I don't know. Okay.
So why don't you like gamification? Right? There's such a huge push.
I think gamification.
Yeah,
so we did have points in there. So I think gamification has to be done very mindfully to not to for two aspects. One, that, you know, if we're dealing with mental health, I think we want to make sure that we respect that for many people, this is a very serious, very challenging thing. And I don't think we want to necessarily transform this into a game for them. I think the other sort of aspect, I borrow a phrase from Ian Bogus that he talks about chocolate-covered broccoli, is that we know chocolate's good, we know broccoli's good for us. Most of us are willing to tolerate broccoli because we know it's good for us, even if we don't love it. We love chocolate, but you know, you don't want to put those two things together. And so I think gamification is that sometimes. It's like, we know health is good for us, we know these things are good, we know games are fun and we like to do them, but you don't want to just spread the games all over the health stuff. So I think that if you, one, sort of belittle a person's emotional experience in the context of mental disorders, and two, make it more about the extrinsic engagement in the gaming component as opposed to the intrinsic value that they get out of the activity, I think that's very challenging. On the same time, we know game mechanics, we know challenges, you know, that's a big part of sort of mental health. Something I say all the time is that, you know, one of the secrets to really getting people, you know, hooked into the things that we do, or, you know, getting people moving in the right direction, is clear goals and immediate feedback. And that, you know, that's a game. So I think that we can integrate gaming elements, but the term gamification, like, scares me sometimes. So that's my gamification rant. Chocolate-covered broccoli. Yeah?
I have a two-part question about the cyber guides. How do you choose which apps you want to evaluate? Second is, you mentioned that the scores are different for your cyber guide ratings and the App Store ratings. I was wondering, what is the correlation between those ratings?
So I think the correlation there is about 0.15. I would have to look it up again. It's pretty low. So I answered that first because it's the easier question to answer. In terms of prioritizing apps, we have sort of a multi-stage prioritization process. We do a consistent review of the scientific literature, again, because we sort of, one of the sort of aspects we're rating things on is credibility. We know that things are going to get higher credibility scores if they're in the scientific literature. And so we try to sort of promote those. We then do sort of a prioritization based on a popularity score that's a combination of the number of downloads and the reviews from the public stores, as well as sort of identification through searches and other appearances in media sources. So if people are talking about it, we want to make sure that it's represented. If there's an app that's up there that's not really being used, people aren't talking about it, like, it's not as important for us to rate, especially if, like, we don't have good evidence that, you know, it has scientific support or sort of clinical content behind it. So those are sort of the main factors we use to sort of identify and to propose them. We also get some sort of self-referrals through, you know, a developer has designed an application, they want it rated on CyberGuide. And so I think we get, you know, like, depending on the week, like 5 to 10 people contacting us about, like, would you post my thing, or would you evaluate this thing that I've seen out there? I think a lot of times we get things of people who've, like, created some sort of self-help site that has, like, just content on it, which is not the sort of stuff we review. And we also get a lot of requests from B2B or, you know, to business products. So platforms that are trying to sell to healthcare settings or to businesses to provide some sort of mental health support for their employees or the folks that they cover. We currently are not evaluating those because we're meant to be a more consumer-facing website. And then the other reason is that a lot of businesses and healthcare systems have the resources to evaluate things and usually have their own sort of evaluation criteria. And so we're really trying to provide a service for people who don't have the resources to evaluate things, or, again, to kind of go back to the American Psychiatric Association framework, maybe don't know how to evaluate it themselves, even if they're given a little bit of a framework. So we're trying to create more information for the people who need it.
I think we have time for one more question. We actually have a talk starting at 3, so we have to be out of the room by 1:45. So one more, and then we'll
do. No one else does. Right. So you mentioned that Thought Challenger, you had very good results with engagement and usage. Yeah. Over your 8-week trial, and you said you didn't think that the coaching was
all of it. Yep.
Was responsible for it.
Well, so I don't think the coaching was all of the engagement. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So what was it about? What
I think one of the reasons is that they were really designed for very simple interactions. They were meant to be brief. that a lot of these other applications we see tend to be multi-featured. So you'd have the thought challenging piece in there with an activity scheduling piece and a logging piece and some mm-hmm. psychoeducational piece. And so you have to really dig into these applications to get the thing that's useful. And so I think that sort of simple design of these applications is actually sort of useful to kind of increase engagement. And I mean, I think that was also shown through at least the way that people engage these things in kind of quick, small bursts. So I think that was one piece of it. I also think that because it's an app suite as opposed to a single application, I think one of the problems I think that mobile mental health faces is that, you know, people, when they go looking for something, they're usually more highly motivated than they're going to be at other things. They might find an application, they might start using it, it might not work, and they might then decide to stop doing it. And, you know, they might have a thought like, I tried that digital mental health stuff and it doesn't work. And I think by reframing this as like an app suite, there's a little bit of a reframe that can happen that, like, we know not everything works for everyone, and that's why we've made out these different options. And so if the first thing you use doesn't work for you, maybe something within the suite will. So what we find in a lot of other areas of psychology, when we have these sort of multimodal sort of stuff, is that these kitchen sink approaches work much better than approaches that have sort of a single, you know, piece to it. And so I think by sort of unpacking the kitchen sink and laying out the tools kind of all separately, it kind of helps people engage with that platform. And that's just sort of my conjecture. You know, we don't have a lot of evidence speaking to that, but, you know, I think that that's a piece that's kind of feeding into it, but we need to do more research to figure that out. It's a good question. Cool.
All right, let's thank our speaker again.
Thanks, everybody.